Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A new report out yesterday from Washington, D.C.'s Department of Health says the city's HIV/AIDS infection rate is now a staggering 3%. A severe epidemic far beyond the national average, rivaling, the report's author said, infection rates in Africa. That got our attention and the world's. This hour, On Point, AIDS in America and what the new numbers out of Washington, D.C. mean. You can join the conversation. Did you think the AIDS epidemic was behind us? Is it in your community, your state? And what's the meaning of the numbers from the District of Columbia? We will talk in a few minutes with the author of the new report out of Washington, D.C. But joining me first today from the Capitol is Washington Post national political reporter Jose Antonio Vargas. He wrote a year-long series on HIV/AIDS in Washington, D.C. in 2006, won a Pulitzer Prize the next year, shared it for reporting on the Virginia Tech shootings. Jose Antonio Vargas, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
We want to look at the numbers and then get behind the numbers. And the one that jumped out at everyone was 3% of D.C. residents infected with HIV or AIDS. We heard that reported in your paper on Monday. And today in your paper, same city officials saying, you know what, it's probably higher.
Yes, it's probably a low figure is 3%. That's the lowest figure probably the city is going to report. What's interesting here is that, you know, this did not happen overnight. It's not as if, you know, Washingtonians woke up and all of a sudden 3%.
Oh, my gosh. Right.
City. Exactly. It did not happen like that. This has been going on for quite many, many years. This is actually why I ended up writing that year-long series in 2006.
But the 3% got everyone's attention because it's so much higher than what we're generally accustomed to. And maybe in no small part because Shannon Hader, who's the director of the HIV/AIDS Administration there in D.C., who we'll speak with in a few minutes, but she's quoted everywhere in the Washington Post and then picked up everywhere saying, our rates are higher than West Africa. They're on par with Uganda and some parts of Kenya. Now West Africa is not the most AIDS-infected part of Africa, so...
No, it's not.
I'm not sure everybody quite understood what she was saying there, but what do you make of that comparison?
Well, what you make of that comparison is that Washington, D.C.'s epidemic is something that can relate in a global perspective. I think what Dr. Hader brings to the table here in D.C., by the way, let me say that she is the 12th director of the AIDS office in the past 23 years.
So they burned through them fast.
The third one in 5 years.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And she is quite qualified. And I think what makes her really unique is the global perspective. She worked in Zimbabwe for 5 years at the CDC. So, you know, when she's talking about comparing Washington, D.C. to West Africa, Uganda, and some parts of Kenya, that's coming from a perspective of a woman who came working from Zimbabwe. But I think even more so than that, I'd really rather not, you know, my job as a reporter was to write the fullest, most balanced story I could. But I think the fact that in 2009, in the United States, in the capital city, as Barack and Michelle Obama are in the White House, we have a 3% infection rate in Washington, D.C. The headline that really grabbed at me, I remember when I first obtained the report, what grabbed at me was when we said that nearly 1 out of 10 D.C. residents ages 40 to 49 is infected. I mean, that's Michelle and Barack Obama's demographic group.
Wow.
So that's interesting to me.
Jose, put that in a national context for us. How does that compare with what you'd find in other cities and beyond urban areas, just generally in the United States?
Well, we have to be careful here in terms of making comparisons. I've been very careful about that in the past 6 years or so that I've been reporting on this because you don't want to compare apples to oranges. What's unique, like let me give you an example. San Francisco has, of course, and New York have been in many ways the epicenters of the disease of HIV, especially especially in the 80s and the 90s. But if you look at San Francisco's epidemic now, which is high, if you look at it, it's a mostly MSM, men who sleep with men, disease. Mm-hmm. By the way, there are three modes of transmission to talk about here. Mm-hmm. There's men who sleep with men, there's heterosexual contact, and there's intravenous drug use, mm-hmm. IDU. Mm-hmm. In San Francisco, it's much more of an MSM disease. In Baltimore, which is nearby D.C., also has a high infection rate, but theirs is a much more historically IDU and also MSM disease. In D.C., what we're seeing is basically the combination of three things happening all at once. Heterosexual contact, IDU, and MSM are all in double digits in terms of infection. So that's interesting.
Interesting to say the least. And remind us just how big a deal a 3% infection rate is. How big, how bad that is in the eyes of people who know HIV AIDS well, as you do.
Well, what surprised me about this whole finding was, why use a percentage, right? I mean, in the past, whenever a city or a state would report its new AIDS cases, it would use a number like 122 per 100,000, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. They use a rate like that.
Right.
D.C. this time said, all right, we're not going to use a rate. We're going to tell you that at least 3% of D.C. residents are HIV positive.
Why not do it that way? Well,
3% is something that people can easily kind of have in their head, right? Mm-hmm, it's not like 124 per 100,000. You do the math. I can't do the math. Like, it's a much easier... It's a much easier way to think of something. Like, if you think of the fact, too, that we're saying in the district that, you know, 7.2% of 40 to 49-year-old, 7%, nearly 7% of all black men in the city. Mm. We're saying that about 3% of all black women, 3% of Hispanic men. Like, when you're out there in the clubs, or you're there talking to friends, this is something that you can throw out. And to give you some historical context here, the first city in the country to give its residents a total percentage of its population that's HIV positive was San Francisco back in 1992 at the height of its epidemic. Mm-hmm. San Francisco's AIDS office said 4% of our population, of our entire population, is HIV positive. Of course, at that time, that was mostly an MSM disease. Mm-hmm. Here in the district, we just said that it's 3%, but it's a generalized disease that's not just affecting gay people, it's affecting straight people too.
But
it runs across demographic groups and age groups.
I think that's what's part of what's really grabbing people here, though, is that the 3% in Washington, D.C. is now saying it's actually probably even higher than that, and that approaches 4%, which we saw as a peak, which we thought we had moved away from, and I guess broadly we have, but here's the District of Columbia really getting our attention. We want to dig into these numbers. Jose Antonio Vargas is with us from the Washington Post, wrote a big year-long series on AIDS in the nation's capital. We're joined right now as well from Washington by the Senior Deputy Director for the District of Columbia's Department of Health, HIV-AIDS Administration, quoted all over the world in the last couple of days on the HIV-AIDS rate there, Shannon Hader. Dr. Hader, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be here.
You have grabbed the world's attention with these numbers. Were you surprised? And what do you mean coming now saying it's probably even higher than 3%?
Well, yeah, I think these are really critical data, really important issues. So, you know, even us, we knew the counts. We knew that this was a problem. When we put our updated counts together with our, you know, our population data, our census data, and we did the math, as Jose said, yeah, we were shocked to say, you know, what does that really mean? Wow, 3% of the entire population, 7% of 40 to 49-year-olds, 6.5% of black men in the city already diagnosed and alive with HIV. And so that's what that means is in terms of this is a minimum count. We know that there are people out there in our district that are infected with HIV but don't know it. Don't know it because they haven't been tested or they haven't been tested recently.
And that means they're not even part of your count because you
so
looked at people who were tested.
Yep. So we looked at people who were diagnosed positive. So if you haven't been diagnosed positive, we can't count you yet. This is definitely an underestimate.
Your numbers are just kind of off the charts when you look around the country. If you do it in terms of number of HIV AIDS cases or living with HIV, I guess. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at a whole complicated chart. AIDS cases per 100,000 population. So that, leave out the HIV alone for a moment. You've got 148 per 100,000. Now, New York City has 24.9 per 100,000, a tiny fraction of that, and they get much, much tinier. I mean, South Dakota has 1.9 per 100,000. How can the District of Columbia live on such a high peak? What's pushing your incidence to such a high proportion compared to other, even major cities, Shannon?
Right. You know, I think we're never surprised when we compare ourselves to South Dakota and have higher rates, right? But I think we are, you know, it is really important when we compare ourselves to like New York City or Detroit or other big urban areas that, mm-hmm. you know, give the same feel as the district. And yeah, our AIDS rates are twice as high as New York City and five times as high as Detroit.
I guess I quoted New York State there at 24.9, but yep. New York City, you say you're twice as high. Yep. Why? Why?
Well, that's a great question. I think there are a lot of contributors that got us to this point. Certainly, you know, one thing we keep coming back to is I think for a while, maybe we took our eyes off the prize. You know, we didn't know what was really going on because we didn't have good enough data to describe who was getting infected here and now, to describe what the epidemic in 2000 or 2008 or 2009 looked like as opposed to what the epidemic in 1985 had looked like.
So is it getting worse, or are you just counting better and publicizing more?
Well, we're counting better, we're publicizing more, and we, fortunately, one of the good news is, you know, part of the reason our rates go up and continue to go up is that people are surviving with HIV and AIDS. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't want to stop counting people because they die. We don't want people to die.
Right.
We want them to stay alive and stay part of those numbers. But at the same time, we know that we have not cut off new HIV transmissions. So in terms of prevention, that's absolutely where we have to focus on, is in stopping ongoing transmission.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the HIV/AIDS rate in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., off the charts, we're being told this week, and looking at where we are in the national battle with AIDS. We've been joined by Shannon Hader. She's Senior Deputy Director for the District of Columbia Department of Health HIV/AIDS Administration, quoted all over the world saying that our rates are higher than West Africa. They're on par with Uganda and some parts of Kenya. She joins us from Washington. Also from Washington, Jose Antonio Vargas, national political reporter for The Washington Post, who wrote a year-long series on HIV/AIDS in the capital. Dr. Hader, Jose, let me begin to hear from our listeners. Nadia in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Nadia, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi, what do you think?
Hi,
yeah.
Hi, I just wanted to comment on, you know, the statistic that D.C. now has a comparable rate to Uganda. And I don't want to discount how critical doubling the numbers from DCR,
mm-hmm.
but it also seems that the comparison to Africa is sort of uncritical, that we play on these stereotypes of Africa, this monolithic, HIV-ridden place, when Uganda, which in fact does have a high proportion of HIV/AIDS, actually is a model, though, for their efforts to decrease that number
mm-hmm.
over, I think, the past 10 years, and has been a model for prevention. And I just think it's interesting, and I haven't really heard many people, I guess, nuance it in that way.
So who's offended in the comparison, Africa or the District of Columbia? Neither? Both?
Sorry?
Who's offended in the comparison, then? You're saying it's a...
Well, I just think it's a little disingenuous, or I think it's maybe sensationalistic that we say, oh, my God, it's the same as Africa, without saying, well, we're comparing it to Uganda, which, in fact, of the African nations or sub-Saharan African nations has done incredible amounts to reduce their rates of HIV/AIDS.
Nadia, let us pick it up. And Shannon Hader, I mean, you've got some credibility here. You once led the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's work in Zimbabwe, so I guess you know of what you speak. On the other hand, it was a very arresting quote, a very arresting comparison. What kind of response have you had to it? Why did you choose to make that comparison?
Well, I made that comparison because I got a direct question about it, actually. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's because of the background I bring, coming back and forth between international and domestic. But, you know, folks ask directly, how do we compare to other places in the rest of the world? So absolutely, Africa as a continent is heterogeneous with HIV and AIDS. Oftentimes we look at, you know, West Africa, Central Africa, East Africa, and Southern Africa, and those regions in themselves have different distributions of rates, but certainly country by country get better. But I have to tell you, one thing that has been really dramatic, and I think why we are asked to put ourselves in perspective with the whole world, is, you know, moving back to the United States after a really fantastic set of accomplishments through PEPFAR and through a lot of the overall global response to HIV, I was struck by the fact that the feeling back here domestically is that somehow the United States has HIV/AIDS under control. That's why we think that HIV is only about Africa or HIV is only abroad.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, here in D.C., I think the conversations we've been having is HIV's right here at home. And that's sometimes why some of those comparisons are needed, to refocus on the fact that back here at home, we also need to aspire to do better. We don't have the epidemic under control. We've got to accelerate. We've got to model after, you know, for D.C., for sure, coverage for our whole community in getting our systems and our responses and our individuals and our families and our communities fully engaged in the response to HIV.
Well, but if it's not under control in the District of Columbia, where you've got this 148 per 100,000 incidence of AIDS, does that suggest it is under control in, you know, I don't know, Montana with 2.6 instead of 148, or in, you know, you name it, Vermont with 1, Wisconsin with 3.5, or not?
Well, I think when you look at the national statistics overall, CDC released some, I think, important data this year about the number of new infections, not just new diagnoses, but the estimated number of new infections for the United States overall. And for years and years and years and years, at a national level, we had said, oh, we have about 40,000 people getting newly infected with HIV every year.
Mm-hmm.
And these new estimates said, actually, you know, we can count better now. We think it's about 56,000 people every year. And my response to that was, wait a second, when did 40,000 new people a year in the United States overall getting newly infected with HIV become okay, become as good as we can do? And so I think it's more than, is it Montana or Vermont? Because I think comparing the issues of Vermont to comparing the issues of Washington, D.C., there's not a one-size-fits-all here. But if we look at the sum total of where we're getting to as a nation overall, we've got some work to do.
Jose Antonio Vargas, can you take us a little deeper into the demographics of what we see in the District of Columbia, where the incidence is heaviest, what we know about how transmission varies between different populations? Help us understand this a little more intimately, Jose.
You know, what's really challenging about HIV, even reporting about it or talking about it, is you're talking about, in many ways, identity politics, right? I mean, you're talking about a lot of demographic groups that have had history or so being, say, marginalized. Like, you're talking about gay people, for example, back in the 80s and 90s.
Well,
right?
I don't know. Lay that out for us. I mean, we'll understand that better if you can tell us who's involved how, I guess.
Well, I mean, back in the 80s and 90s when ACT UP, right, was mm-hmm. basically the rallying cry of, you know, give us health care, give us drugs, give
right.
us – I mean, that was the rallying cry back in the 80s and 90s. And now let's make sure we say this too. I mean, of course, what makes the district unique in terms of infection rate is the high heterosexual transmission mode. But men who sleep with men still make up the largest proportion of new HIV infections, not just in the city talking about, but also nationally.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something to be said about why that's going on. And in reporting on these issues, what I find really interesting is you're talking about sex, for one thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about drugs, and you're talking about the relationships that people have with each other, the sexual relationships that people have with each other. And I think sometimes that makes it really difficult for people to be honest with each other about exactly what it is that they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
To me, what's so striking about the reports that we just released is Shannon Hader's office also conducted through George Washington University a report on heterosexual relationships, basically a survey of 750 people in the city who are living in high AIDS prevalence areas, neighborhoods, and also high poverty rate, people who make less than $10,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
What was so striking is that of the 75% who said that they were in a relationship, nearly half of them thought that their partner was sleeping with another person and they themselves were sleeping with another person, and that only 30% of them said that they had used a condom the last time mm-hmm. they slept with somebody. I mean, if you're talking about something like that, I mean, you're talking about an environment, right, a 3% infection rate environment, and you have behavior like that. In many ways, you can say that it's not a surprise that we're seeing
no.
this kind of epidemic.
And identity politics, I guess, because people identify with different stripes of the problem. And you
exactly.
report here more than 4% of blacks in the District of Columbia known to have HIV, 2% of Latinos, 1.4% of whites, more than three-quarters, 76% of the HIV-infected are black, 70% mm-hmm. men, 70% are age 40 and older. Shannon,
that's key.
And you can see how identity politics come out of that. Shannon, what about the gay-straight proportions, the male-female proportions here?
Well, I think overall when you look at everybody who's currently alive with HIV/AIDS in the district today, it's about 70% men and 30% women in terms of the folks that are living with HIV and AIDS. But again, as Jose is pointing out, some of that's shifting. So when we look at more newly diagnosed folks, we see more and more women getting diagnosed. But importantly, I think also when we, you know, we sort of took the counterpoint too and say, well, if we break down these data and look at them in different ways, whether it's age or geography or race or sex, who's not affected? Is there anyone who's not affected as opposed to just who's the most affected? And I think that was also what's striking about the report. You know, you break down by geography and essentially, you know, 7 out of our 8 wards have substantially huge HIV rates. So pretty much almost every ward is very much affected. Almost every race gender group has a rate approaching or surpassing 1%, if not going higher from there.
Which is called a generalized and severe epidemic.
Yeah, it's a 1% population rate is usually what gets the attention of WHO and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention saying, you know, you've got a big problem here. It's not just isolated to a few people or a few activities or a few blocks of a society. It's affecting a large portion of the population.
Let's get a call from Buffalo, New York, and Amy. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, what do you know?
Well, I have a degree in African American studies, and I've been following this debate for many years. And the one major issue that I have never heard raised in this debate is the role that incarceration plays in spreading the virus. And we know it's a well-established fact that about 1 in 3 black men get recycled through the corrective system, prison, parole, probation.
I have to say I hate that phrase, get recycled through the correction system, but we understand what you mean.
It is terrible. But 1 in 3 is the stat, and often we hear about black men being on the down low, but I think that's rather overblown when we consider that prison sex and prison rape is probably a more closeted issue and is underreported.
On the down low, meaning male-male sex, yeah?
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. And I highly doubt that black men are discussing what's really happening behind prison walls. Their bodies aren't their own there, and I'm wondering what your commentators think about this issue, whether anyone's examining it, and whether any measures are being taken to distribute condoms in prisons.
Amy, thanks very much. Jose Antonio Vargas, what did you find in your reporting? You talked with a lot of people. Amy's asking if this is coming out of prisons, a population facing a lot of incarceration.
I'd like Dr. Hayter to talk about that as well, just because she has mm-hmm. a very nuanced view of this. But mm-hmm. let me just say that the district was actually the first city in the country, the first jail in the country, in D.C. jail, to have people get tested for HIV in prison. So that's unique. And that happened, I believe, in 2006. You do see here in the district what I found interesting when I spent maybe 6 months with a group of HIV-positive ex-cons. Mm-hmm. It's a support group of people. A couple of them actually were talking to me about how young African-American kids inside prison, like young inmates, were basically sharing dirty needles when they're putting tattoos on each other, mm-hmm. and how that can be really dangerous. I thought that was an interesting point. But I don't think – I think that depends – the effect of the incarceration rate depends on what city we're talking about here. Actually, Dr. Hayter was talking to us a couple of weeks ago, and she said that, well, you know – if you have an inmate who's about to be released from prison and then that person is going back into the community, into a community that has a 3% infection rate, right? I mean, where is that inmate safer, inside the jail or outside of jail in terms of passing around the epidemic? Mm. So I thought that was an interesting point.
Dr. Hayter, how do you look at the effect, if you see one, of incarceration rates?
Well, I think incarceration is a huge issue, and we do have, unfortunately, a lot of our district residents and our district neighbors who have had experience being in jail or being in prison. Just to echo what Jose said, we fortunately have a fantastic routine voluntary HIV screening program with our Department of Corrections, with our jails. So, and actually, that's one of the best places in the city to go to make sure you're going to get routinely offered an HIV test. Folks who are tested in the jails get diagnosed earlier in their disease. They have lower mortality rates. And fortunately, we have discharge, making sure they're hooked up into good health care when they come out, very well taken care of. So what we've really been starting to focus on much more, I think, much more nuanced, as Jose is saying, is in fact, compared to a lot of places, believe it or not, the HIV rates of our men in jail are actually lower than our general community HIV rates for men. And so we also want to focus on folks who test negative when they're in jail, and also let people who are coming back from prison realize, you know what, you're coming back into an environment where there's a lot of HIV out there.
Wow.
A lot of studies for people getting out of prison, you know, confirm that within the first week out of prison, the majority of men have had unprotected sex. So it's not usually the first thing on your mind, HIV and using condoms, when you get out of prison for
so
a long
more
time.
More worried on the outside. Shannon Hader, Jose Antonio Vargas, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Phil Wilson. He joins us from New York, founder and executive director of the Black AIDS Institute. It's a group dedicated to ending AIDS in African-American communities. Phil Wilson, thank you very much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You put out a statement right away on the report out of Washington. You called, it says the AIDS epidemic in Washington, D.C. is an unmitigated disaster and a national disgrace. How do you look at it?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We've been having this conversation about the AIDS epidemic in Washington, D.C., and actually the AIDS epidemic in Washington, D.C. is actually a canary in the mine shaft. It gives us a view into the window of what's happening with the AIDS epidemic all across black America today. AIDS in America today is a black disease, no matter how you look at it, through the lens of gender or sexual orientation or age or education or socioeconomic status or where you live. Black people bear the burden of the AIDS epidemic. Earlier, you were comparing the AIDS epidemic in Washington, D.C. to parts of Africa. But if you look at black America as if it were a country unto itself, what we would know is that the AIDS epidemic in black America is worse than the AIDS epidemic that you would find in Rwanda, in Haiti, in Namibia, in Vietnam, in Botswana, and Ethiopia, for example. So what we're seeing is that, you know, the while Washington, D.C. is a microcosm of what's happening, quite frankly, when you have prolonged neglect, and that's really what's happened, particularly around the domestic epidemic in general, and that translates to a devastating effect in black America, you know, that the numbers in Washington, D.C. among blacks in D.C. are worse than the general population. So if we have a generalized epidemic when we have a 3% epidemic in Washington, D.C., and we have a 4% epidemic among blacks, and we have a 10% epidemic among 40 to 49-year-olds, and a 7% epidemic among black men in Washington, D.C., you see the magnitude of the epidemic as it's impacting black folks. And that's true also in Detroit and in St. Louis and in parts of New York and Oakland and other places where there are large black populations.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the HIV/AIDS rate in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., off the charts, and where we are in the national battle with AIDS. We've been joined by Shannon Hader. She's in charge of looking out for HIV/AIDS in Washington, D.C., Senior Deputy Director for the District of Columbia Department of Health HIV/AIDS Administration. Previously worked for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Zimbabwe. She joins us from Washington. Jose Antonio Vargas with the Washington Post, reporter there, spent a year in 2006 putting out a year-long series on HIV/AIDS in the district. He knows that situation well. And with us from New York, somebody with a national perspective here and a racial perspective, Phil Wilson joins us. He's founder and executive director of the Black AIDS Institute, a group dedicated to ending AIDS in African-American communities. John, in Amherst, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Yes, I wanted to point out that D.C. is not represented. You know, the statehood
In Congress, yeah.
Yes, yes. So
in the vote.
Right, exactly. And it would be nice, you know, for those purposes. But I think we have to look at the bigger picture of all the other statistics that are distressing and alarming. We look at the dropout rates. We look at drug use. We look at the homicide rates. And all these are symptomatic of poverty. So let's look at the big picture and ask ourselves, what can we do to deal with the overarching kind of cultural attitudes of, well, everyone out for themselves, and how can we create this society to be more compassionate?
Shannon Hader, I'll put that to Phil Wilson, but first to you, what about the elements here, poverty, race, mm-hmm. racism, lack of political representation? I don't know, how do you factor in the big pieces that hit Washington?
You know, I'm actually going to start with that last one, lack of political representation. I think we have a really distinctive existence here in the district, and a lack of a vote has a direct impact in many cases on our ability and our freedom as local jurisdiction to do what's right for our own residents.
But on whether or not a two people use protection or
well,
share
I'll
a needle?
I'll give you a really specific example. Until the end of December 2007, we were not allowed as a district to use our local generated tax dollars to fund needle exchange programs. That's because Congress added a provision to the budget prohibiting us from doing what every other local jurisdiction can decide to do with its own money, not its federal monies. So that for many, many years, and it was just lifted last year thanks to some intensive lobbying efforts of Representative Eleanor Holmes Norton and Jose Serrano, who chaired the committee, that let us for the first time be free to immediately start funding comprehensive harm reduction programs, including needle exchange for the city. So actually, this representation and our distinctive role does have a direct effect on our mm-hmm. not being able to always provide the services, certainly for HIV, but across a complexity of issues to our residents that are appropriate for our residents.
What about a racial perspective on this? Phil Wilson is very ready and willing to pull out the black population in Washington, its incidence of HIV/AIDS, and one up you on your comparison to Africa. He's saying if you do that, it's actually worse than the worst spots in Africa, worse than Rwanda. What do you make of that kind of comparison, Shannon? I mean, is that meaningful to you? Is that helpful or beside the point, Shannon Hader?
Well, I think we're saying some of the same things. We're not worse than the worst parts of Africa. You know, I've worked in the worst parts of Africa, which are really southern Africa, that have rates
okay.
that go up to 20-25%.
Ooh, yeah,
but I think
yeah.
it is really important to say, you know, the numbers are the numbers. And if we want to take things seriously, we do have to look at the numbers. And, you know, they're not drama. They're real numbers. And so I think giving the attention to the vast number of people in our country who are suffering from HIV and AIDS and need additional services, additional reach, additional information, additional supports to stay negative or to live healthily, yeah, I applaud the efforts to highlight these issues.
And Phil Wilson, what about our caller mentioned many things, but part of the equation there was sort of poverty equals AIDS. Do you buy that, Mr. Wilson?
Well, I don't buy that poverty equals AIDS, and I think we need to be careful about pathologizing the epidemic and pathologizing those folks who are most impacted by the epidemic.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
I do think that some of the things your caller mentioned are relevant. Shannon talked about representation and how does that factor in. It factors in with a local community's ability to respond to the needs of its local citizens as opposed to being vulnerable to the cultural mandates or cultural mores of folks who don't have any relationship to the population. Earlier you compared North Dakota. Well, why should a senator from North Dakota now have a voice in the lives of citizens in Washington, D.C.? The people who vote for him have no connection to the people who live in Washington, D.C. And the result of that is you have policies that not only do not help but do harm in the district and in urban America. For example, Shannon talked about needle exchange,
mm-hmm.
but we could add to the list of bad HIV/AIDS policies the abstinence-only programs that were supported by the federal government, the inability for places like the District of Columbia to use culturally appropriate appropriate explicit HIV messages with their constituents because those messages might offend the senators from North Dakota and South Dakota and Wyoming and et cetera. But I think it's really important for us to look at, now, what are the solutions? You know, how are we going to get out of this mess? Shannon is absolutely right. The numbers are the numbers, mm-hmm. and how we got there is important to know how we get there, but it's more important for us to have conversations about how we're going to turn this around. So, for example, 40% of the HIV-positive folks in Washington, D.C. in the study did not know that they were HIV-positive.
Right.
We know that 75% of new infections in this country are caused by people who do not know. So we need a national social marketing campaign to increase testing and triage into care mm-hmm. and treatment in our communities. You know, that's an example of something yep. we need to talk about. We need to talk about one of the reasons why it's legitimate to compare the AIDS epidemic in Washington, D.C. and in Black America as a whole to the developing world is that we have seen success through the PEPFAR program, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, in providing treatment and driving down infection
in Africa,
in places like Uganda. Mm-hmm. We need a PEPFAR program in the United States. Now, a program that actually looks at measurable goals and objectives. You know,
yep.
when the U.S. gives money to foreign countries, now, it requires them to have a national AIDS strategy. But here in the U.S., we don't have a national AIDS strategy. You know, and as my grandmother used to say, if you fail to plan, you plan to fail.
I want to take that to Shannon Hader and Jose Antonio Vargas, but we've got so many listeners who want to come in as well. Let me get a few first. David in San Francisco, California. You're on the air, David.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
In listening to the comments, that you know, the comparison to Rwanda is probably the most accurate. If you take a look back to the 1990s when I used to live in D.C.,
okay.
I mean, the
Why?
Area was exactly... Because there was an extremely high amount of crime and violence, especially in Southeast Washington, D.C., where this AIDS epidemic really got a foothold. The CDC, as well as D.C., were pretty much in a phase of benign neglect. No one was really spreading any type of information about how to slow the spread of AIDS. The numbers you give today, they don't shock me at all. Because, you know, I used to work in and around D.C. A lot of my friends were gay.
Yep.
And on any given day, in any given restaurant or store, they could point to individual men who are walking around with their families who had gay lovers practicing unprotected sex, but were still, for lack of a better term, masquerading as heterosexual men.
So if you don't talk about it and you don't address it, you shouldn't be surprised 10 years later if you've got the problem, I guess.
Not at all. And if you want to know where the next hot button is, the exact same things they're talking about in D.C. right now are happening in Atlanta, Georgia today.
We'll
and
keep
that's going to be the next hot spot.
David, thanks for calling. Dan in Fort Myers, Florida, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that I think one of the main problems with the whole thing and the reason the rates are still increasing is because of the last 8 years and the ideal of abstinence-only education. I think that the key to changing the rising rates is education. People, and especially young people, need to understand that they're not immune to it. If they're heterosexual, they can still get AIDS. It's not a disease that's relegated just to gay people and drug users who use needles.
Yeah, Dan, we've got it. So there's gay openness as an issue. Education is an issue. Let's get one more from Los Angeles, California. Saad, you're on the air, Saad.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you know?
Excellent topic. I have two questions, actually, for the panel. The first one is, AIDS used to be an HIV, a universally fatal illness in the 80s and 90s, but now we have very successful treatments called HART, highly active antiretroviral therapy.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how much has the treatment actually contributed to relaxation of the preventative attitude, such as use of condom or abstinence, to the rise in the epidemic that we're recently seeing.
That's a great question.
Yeah. My second question is that we're also seeing a rise among adolescents and younger population, and how much has that also contributed to the rise of the epidemic that we're seeing in Washington, D.C. right now?
Adolescents driving. Shannon Hader, let's start with the last. What about antiretroviral therapies? I mean, they have helped an awful lot of people stay alive and live you know, decent lives for a long time. Saad wonders if they lead also to a relaxation of vigilance.
Well, you know, I think those kinds of conversations are always under debate, but I sort of come down universally with the overriding statement that antiretroviral drugs are a good thing. It's a great thing that we're not where we are in 1985. It's a great thing that AIDS doesn't need to be a death sentence, and it's a great thing that people can stay alive and live long and healthy lives if they access the services that they need for their health. So, you know, I've got to put that premise out there because sometimes that gets lost in the mix. Does that mean we're in a different environment? Does that mean, as Phil is, you know, mentioning, when we plan for going forward, we've got to plan in the context of this being a serious chronic disease? And I think, yeah, we do have to plan that way. I think people can throw around a lot of phrases cavalierly about being less worried. But the fact is, very few people really want to get HIV. And so I think we got to hone in on how do we help people stay negative, not by overt threats and the horrible death and destruction that we all saw in the 80s and 90s, but based on, you know, what needs to happen for a lifetime of health here and now. Mm.
Jose Antonio Vargas, what about our caller David in San Francisco, who looks back to his time in Washington in the 90s, saying he knew, he saw a lot of gay sexuality on the side, on the down low, and unacknowledged, and therefore more dangerous. Is there a cultural piece of this that needs more surfacing?
I mean, of course, but I think we have to be careful, and we have to be, like for example, the myth of the down low black man. I mean, there's always been down low guys of every racial background.
So that's a myth.
Remember, I mean, it's not that it's a myth, but as Mr. Phil Wilson was saying, you know, let us not kind of pathologize and kind of, you know, put in a corner certain parts of the population. I think it's important here to look at kind of the universality of this, and that men in the down low or men in the closet, that runs across racial demographics. I mean, Hispanic men, white men, Asian men, black men, right? But what I think what's even more crucial here, you know, I'm actually working on the series that I ended up writing 3 years ago is now a subject of a documentary, and it's called The Other City. And so in doing the documentary, you know, I mean, of course, we're also focused on the statistics, but more than that, we're focused on kind of telling individual stories and how certain people who are infected got to the point where they are infected. How did that happen? Like, what kind of circumstances, what kind of choices, what kind of circumstances, what kind of situations happened to put them in that situation? And I think one of your callers brought up this point of compassion, this idea that, you know, sometimes I wonder, I mean, Dr. Hayter was making up a point that when did it become okay that 40,000 Americans get infected with HIV every year, which is now actually 56,300 people? When did that become okay? And when people become HIV positive, and we're talking about this right now, what I find really fascinating is it's almost as if we have a sort of fatigue. You know, it's almost as if we always think that AIDS is over there. It's never here. It's over there. It doesn't affect me. It's the other people that get it.
Jose, hold the thought. I want to go to Phil Wilson with all this, but I've got a question on this compassion front, or a comment.
From
Wittensville, Massachusetts, Ewan. Ewan, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. One way of working out whether we should care here is how much money do these people pay into the system over their lifetime?
What system? What system, Ewan?
Into Social Security.
You mean if they don't pay in enough or much, then don't care?
What happens is that these people pay money into the Social Security system, and then they die, but it also costs money to treat them. And does society make any profit on that?
Profit.
And if society makes a profit, we shouldn't care. But if society, if it costs society more to treat them, we should care.
But they're not widgets. Phil Wilson, how do you hear this whole conversation?
Well, that certainly is not the America that I want to live in, where we determine the value of a human being based on whether or not they cost society or not. And I don't think that's the America that most Americans want to live in, and that's certainly not the America that the American people were thinking about when they went to the polls in November.
Even in those cold terms, we actually need their productive input. You know, we need what they bring to the table. Your big takeaway, Phil?
Well, I would actually go back to, part of the challenge is that we, again, as we will today, spend so much time talking about the problem and so little time talking about the solutions.
Mm-hmm.
Today we've not talked about the fact that if we want to talk about ending the AIDS epidemic, we need to talk about things like, while it takes two people to transmit the epidemic, it only takes one person to stop a transmission. And how do we help people understand that, and how do we help people, translate that into their behavior?
Safe sex.
Safe sex, for example, and clean needles and all the ways that they can protect themselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How do we raise the HIV science literacy in communities? One of the things that we know that's happening is that in poor communities and in many urban communities and certainly in black communities, there is a lack of understanding of the basic science about HIV and AIDS, and that undermines people's ability to take action. So we have to talk about how to move people to action.
Phil Wilson, you are exactly right. We'll do more on that. It's been fascinating and important, though, to see what's going on here through this report out this week. Phil, at the Black AIDS Institute in New York, founder and executive director there, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
And Jose Antonio Vargas at the Washington Post, thank you for your work, and thanks for being here today, Jose.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And Shannon Hader with the District of Columbia, thanks for joining us, Shannon.
Thanks for helping to get the word out, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.